Anybody who is there to uphold the law cannot act like they're above the law.
From Pacifica Radio's KPFK in Los Angeles, this is the Bradcast, as heard on 90.7 FM in LA. In Oregon, 91.7 FM KYAQ on the Central Coast, 106.7 FM KSO in Cottage Grove, Oregon, 93 FM WLRI in lovely Lancaster, Pennsylvania, 88.5 FM KAKU, the voice of Maui. And of course, coast to coast and around the globe on kpfk.org, on iTunes, streaming on the Progressive Voices channel, on Netroots Radio, Indie Media Weekly, FYI Nation, the awesome radioornot.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, and of course, Radio Sputnik, 5 days a week. With or without me, this is your Bradcast. I am Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around still kind of ill fellow from bradblog.com. Glad you could join us today for another action-packed, thrilling adventure. Glad I can join us today for another thrilling, action-packed adventure. Glad you, Desi Doyen, can join us today for a thrilling, action-packed adventure. How are you doing?
I'm doing better, too. Thank
okay,
you.
Okay, good. Glad to know it. And I need to thank our friend Nicole Sandler, who we got sick last week. We both, Desi and I, got just punched in the face, kind of like out of nowhere. Everything was fine on Monday, and then boom. Before we could do anything on Tuesday, we just both were just taken down, and it was ugly. And we were able to call Nicole Sandler, our friend from radioornot.com, she was going to come in and cover for us for a couple of days anyway around the holiday at the end of the week. But we made an emergency call. We had to call the bat phone, I guess, to call Nicole to say, hey, can you help us out? We can't talk. We can't say anything. So she was able to jump in at the very last second, covered for us for more days than she had planned. So Nicole Sandler, thank you very much. And by the way, be sure to listen to her show over on radioornot.com every day of the week. She had some great broadcasts. I enjoyed listening to them. I didn't have a lot to do because I was sick for the entire holiday. So I listened to them, including a rather contentious interview that she did with Congressman Alan Grayson. He's running for
Florida Senate
for the nomination in the Democratic Party for the nomination for the U.S. Senate in Florida. And she was challenging him because he apparently endorsed Hillary Clinton. And now I guess Nicole has interviewed Congressman Grayson many times. They know each other a little bit at least. And she held his feet to the fire. You can go back to bradblog.com or over to iTunes and listen to those shows that you might have missed over the past week, including that one. They were even talking about that on Hartman. I heard somebody mention that on Tom Hartman's show. Her interview with Alan Grayson.
Yes, it's a very interesting interview and very uncomfortable too.
Really?
In a good way.
You think?
Yeah, I thought so.
Okay.
Really cool.
Yeah, well, you know, hey, politics, it ain't beanbag, as they say. So check out that interview. She covered Donald Trump's march towards fascism with our friend Howie Cohn.
Klein,
I'm sorry. See, I'm still sick. Get used to it. She had on the Kurdish representative to the U.S. to learn us all a little bit about the Kurds and their struggle. So great shows. Thank you so much, Nicole, for doing that. Hopefully we continue to be on the mend, and hopefully you out there can stand to hear me sound a little bit clogged up today. I will be interviewing shortly the independent journalist who helped bring us the video, the dash cam video out of Chicago of the killing of 17-year-old Laquan McDonald by Officer Jason Van Dyke. We'll be speaking with that independent journalist shortly about the latest in the case in Chicago. That officer has now been charged with first-degree murder, and about his the journalist, Brandon Smith's, about his work in bringing that video to light. Oh, it took more than a year for it to come to light, as apparently the Chicago police and, I don't know, perhaps the mayor's office, corporate mainstream media, all sort of participated in this remarkable cover-up over the past year. So looking forward to talking to him about that. Meanwhile, gathering in Paris over the last several days, the largest gathering of world leaders ever.
Yes.
Ever.
Yes.
So obviously, it must be for an important reason. Clearly, it's to do battle with ISIS or whatever the greatest threat is. That what is the greatest threat that this planet faces that would bring all of the world leaders together? I think more than 180 or so of the world leaders, including President Obama.
Oh, yeah. 150 world leaders altogether. 192 member countries for the United Nations. The existential threat, not to the planet, but to human civilization, which is posed by climate change.
What
this United Nations gathering is to do is to create an agreement, a treaty framework for how to proceed after 2020 in reducing the greenhouse gas emissions that cause dangerous climate change. And hopefully, the goal is to keep global temperatures from rising beyond 2 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels. Yeah. We are already at 1 degree Celsius above pre-industrial levels. We are running out of time. But what's remarkable about this agreement is that all nations have agreed for the very first time to reduce the emissions that cause global warming.
To reduce emissions, keeping it below 2 degrees Celsius, which is about, what, 4 something?
It's a 3.9 degrees Fahrenheit.
Keeping it below 2 by the end of this century?
By the end of this century, right.
Impossible. Not going to happen, says me.
Totally wrong about that. It is totally possible. We already have all the tools that we need off the shelf right now. What we lack is the political will, and that is what this conference is intended to create and set up. It is going to be an architecture, a framework. No matter what happens, this agreement will not solve climate change. It is the framework for getting it started.
Yeah, well, we'll see if Little Miss Optimism there is right as the week goes on. Actually, the next 2 weeks, this conference will be going on. The world leaders are there for the next day or two. I think tomorrow we're speaking with someone in Paris covering the conference. So I suspect we will also, of course, be covering it on our Green News Report.
Oh, yes.
I think we'll be covering it in a number of ways, quite a bit, over the next week
two. Oh, yeah, way more to come, don't worry.
As COP, what do they call it? COP21.
Yes.
The Conference of the Parties.
Correct. This is the 21st meeting of the Conference of Parties, COP21.
Okay, not to be confused with the cops in this country who are shooting people left and right that we're going to be covering shortly.
That's right.
Okay. Very good. So we will be covering that in the days and weeks ahead. Desi Doyen, I know you've been quite anxious, itching to cover, itching for this conference to finally come about. So we will look forward to that. Meanwhile, over the past week, when we were sick, it was amazing enough, frankly, before we got sick. The nation was, and the world was, frankly, on edge about the possibility of terror attacks over the Thanksgiving holiday. GOPers were busy inciting fear over Syrian refugees. There was concern whether this conference in Paris would happen at all, given those the attacks, the November 13 attacks in Paris. But oddly enough, with everyone heading into the holidays, everyone worried about, oh my God, is ISIS, will ISIS strike again? Will the Syrian refugees who have attacked nobody, will they suddenly start attacking people or something? I don't. It was just, that was sort of the mood as we were heading into the week. into the weekend, into the holiday. And then what do you know? Well, what did we actually see last week? Well, we saw white terrorists shooting up a white terrorist shooting up a Planned Parenthood. We saw white terrorists stalking a mosque in Texas with rifles. I can only imagine. Had there been a non-white man, had there been a Muslim stalking, let's say, a synagogue with rifles or a church with rifles. And we saw a shooting at a Black Lives Matter protest in Minneapolis, but it wasn't the Black Lives Matter protesters shooting anybody. It was apparently white supremacists doing so. Four men have now been charged in the shooting of those protesters. I know Nicole covered the story a bit last week. Well, now the charges have come down. Alan Lawrence Scarsella, one of the four men who allegedly gunned down Minneapolis protesters last week, has now been charged with five counts of assault with a dangerous weapon and one count of rioting while armed. He's a 23-year-old. He's accused of shooting and injuring five Black Lives Matter supporters on November 23. Authorities have also charged three others with riot counts. The victims of the shooting were camped out near Minneapolis's 4th Precinct, where they were protesting the police shooting of 24-year-old Jamar Clark. According to demonstrators, four masked men arrived at the scene and started filming the protesters. Before the masked men then opened fire, the shooters refused to take off their masks or leave the protest prior to opening fire. Demonstrators described the perpetrators as white supremacists. The shooters are said to have yelled, quote, race war and Trump 2016. Despite the attack, community members have remained at the encampment to demand justice. For Clark, 24-year-old Jamar Clark, who was shot in the head by police. Hundreds of protesters have taken to the streets following his death. The Minneapolis Police Department, for their part, maintains that an officer fired his gun during a physical altercation with Clark. That sounds familiar. The department also claims that Clark was not handcuffed at the time. As witnesses now claim, protesters have called for release of video footage of that deadly encounter, but local and federal investigators have declined to do so. Does that sound familiar? Yeah, that sounds familiar. That sounds just exactly like what happened in Chicago that we will be talking about shortly with Brandon Smith. Meanwhile, in Colorado Springs, the day after Thanksgiving, a man killed three people in that women's health clinic and injured nine others at the Planned Parenthood. The man reportedly told law enforcement, quote, no more baby parts, which is a reference to the to those videos that were made by that James O'Keefe related group who, you know, puts out heavily doctored and edited videos to hoax people, right wingers. These are right wingers who put out this nonsense to hoax people into whatever the hell it is they can't, you know, advocate for legitimately. So, of course, we've had all of these right wingers, these Republicans talking about Planned Parenthood selling baby parts for profit. Of course, they do not. But that's what the right wingers have been talking about. That's what the Republicans have been talking about. That's what the presidential candidates have been talking about. And now, apparently, that is what the man in Colorado Springs who shot three people, including a cop, killed. I'm sorry, he actually killed three people, including one cop. He injured nine others, including about four or five other cops. That is what that man was saying, reportedly. No more baby parts. As Ian Millhiser pointed out at Think Progress thereafter, you are more than seven times as likely to be killed by a right-wing extremist like that guy at the Planned Parenthood than you are by Muslim terrorists. University of North Carolina professor Charles Kurtzman and Duke professor David Shanzer explained last June in the New York Times that Islam-inspired terror attacks accounted for 50 fatalities over the past 13 and a half years. Meanwhile, right-wing extremists averaged 337 attacks per year in the decade since 9/11, causing a total of 254 fatalities. So if you're worried about the threat from extremists, it ain't Muslim extremists you got to worry about. It's right-wing American extremists you want to worry about in this country. Meantime, the violence against U.S. abortion clinics continues to be amazing. As Rula Jibril points out on Twitter, since 1977, there have been 8 murders at U.S. abortion clinics, 41 bombings, 173 arsons, 619 bomb threats, and 1,264 incidents of vandalism. I suspect some of those numbers have gone up in just the past few days. We've talked on this program about the report put out by the draft report put out by the Department of Homeland Security concerning right-wing extremism that the Republicans were so furious about that they were able to get the Obama administration to retract that report, even though it was begun during the Bush administration, and even though I don't believe they ever retracted their report on left-wing extremism, such that it exists. So there you go. For all of the Sturm und Drang about Muslims and ISIS and Syrian refugees, apparently, as we were going into the holidays, you know, all of this stuff that's been going on, particularly that attack on Planned Parenthood in Colorado Springs, reminds us once again, as the movie phrase goes, the call, it seems, is coming from inside the house. We're going to take a quick break and come back with Brandon Smith. Speaking of calls coming from inside the house, I'm Brad Friedman. This is your Bradcast. Stay tuned.
Hi, this is Desi Doyen from the Green News Report and the Bradcast, both brought to you without corporate or political influence. Why? Because we rely on you to help keep us completely independent. Please drop by bradblog.com/donate today and help us stay on your public airwaves. That's bradblog.com/donate. You'll thank yourself later. I'll thank you now.
Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com with you here. Last week, just before the Thanksgiving holiday, and just hours before the release of a year-old video taken by the Chicago Police Department, Jason Van Dyke, a white Chicago police officer, was charged with first-degree murder for the killing of Laquan McDonald, a black 17-year-old who was shot by Van Dyke 16 times more than 1 year earlier on October 20, 2014. As Kevin Gazzola reports, it is the first time in Chicago history that an officer faces criminal charges for an on-duty shooting. When the 17-year-old McDonald was killed, Chicago police claimed that McDonald had been, quote, crazed, had slashed the tires of a squad car and refused to drop his knife, that he, quote, lunged at officers, giving them no choice but to shoot him, presumably for their own safety. Last April, the city of Chicago gave $5 million to the McDonald family as a settlement, but barred the family and their attorney from releasing the dash cam video of the incident. They were paid, taxpayers paid, to make the entire incident go away. And it might have, had independent activists and investigators, including 29-year-old journalist Brandon Smith, not kept digging, filing Freedom of Information Act requests, and then sued when the city failed to properly respond to those requests. Among the information revealed by independent investigators was the autopsy report revealing that Van Dyke had shot McDonald in the left scalp, neck, left and right chest, left elbow, upper arm, left forearm, right upper leg, left upper back, left elbow, right upper arm, right forearm, right hand, right lower back, and right upper leg. When the dash cam video of the incident was finally released last week upon court order, it was revealed that Officer Van Dyke was on the scene for just about 30 seconds before he unloaded his 9mm caliber semi-automatic pistol into McDonald, who had been walking down the middle of the street with a small 3-inch long blade that we have later learned was actually folded into its handle. He did not lunge at the officers. In fact, he was walking away from them. After the incident last year, Van Dyke was put on desk duty while investigations took place, but he was not fired or suspended. It appears to be only thanks to the dogged persistence of journalists like Brandon Smith that the entire incident eventually came to light, both in the city of Chicago and, as we saw last week and this week, on a national level. At a bond hearing at the Cook County Criminal Courthouse on November 24, Judge Donald Panarese Jr. ordered Van Dyke to be jailed without bond until Monday, until the court was allowed to view the video in question. On Monday, Van Dyke was freed on $150,000 bail paid for by the Chicago's Fraternal Order of Police, the police union. Today, Mayor Rahm Emanuel announced that he was dismissing Chicago Police Superintendent Gary McCarthy, who he had previously supported. So why did it take more than a year before this video came to light? And given that Van Dyke was charged just hours before the release of the video, would he have been charged at all if not for the court-ordered release of that video? Meanwhile, what else and who else is being covered up in this affair? Describing the video just after its release last week, Brandon Smith, writing over at the UK's Guardian, wrote, "The police dashboard camera footage shows a Chicago officer shooting 17-year-old Laquan, but it's utterly without fireworks. It's perfunctory. The lack of sound and the cold way the officers moved and behaved made a horrifying act seem almost mundane. The tape shows Jason Van Dyke, the officer now charged with Laquan's murder, leaving his police car. A few short seconds elapse with Van Dyke's gun drawn, and before Laquan has a chance to say anything, the teen falls to the ground. That's it. To the world, Laquan died quietly," writes Smith. "Officers stand around, not helping the boy, seemingly securing the scene from an invisible threat. Little did they know, the threat is them." Here to talk about the case and his efforts to shed light on the incident that would have otherwise disappeared entirely, and frankly, on too many other incidents like it in Chicago and beyond, is Brandon Smith, the independent journalist whose dogged efforts here helped bring both the alleged murder and its apparent attempted cover-up to the nation's attention. Brandon Smith is a Chicago-based independent journalist who, with the help of whistleblowers and the Freedom of Information Act, has reported on civil rights abuses, privatization of public assets, digital privacy concerns, and pollution of land and water. Brandon Smith, sir, welcome to the broadcast.
Wow, what an introduction. Thank you. I tell you, I stand on the shoulders of giants here with this case. I'm just, you know, one of many independent folks who are trying to track this down. But yeah, I appreciate the recognition and you covering the story.
Well, listen, I understand what it's like. I've been I became especially interested in this story, frankly, once I saw that you were an independent journalist, not a member of the corporate media, and that you were instrumental in getting to the bottom of this story with your independent work. I see you've been doing it since 2007. Your blog is called Muckrakery, which I love. So your work reminds me a lot of the independent work we've done at bradblog.com for so many years. So I want to talk about that and the video itself. And I want to discuss where the hell the rest of Chicago's media were this whole time. But first, what do you mean when you write at the Guardian, Brandon, that the threat is them, meaning the Chicago police?
Wow. Yeah, that's what I was really meaning there was I had been getting a lot of interview requests around the time I wrote that column. Mm-hmm. And everyone wanted to talk about whether I thought the protests about this issue would end up in being violent, you know, being mm-hmm. riotous.
Right.
And I really took every interview request I could get to set the record straight that there's very little chance it's going to be violent, and it really wasn't by and large. And just even if it was, like, even if there was some property destruction or something, that doesn't matter when you set it in comparison to police violence. Frankly, it just, you know, if there's some property damage, like because people are angry, like they're compared to the 70 people who have died at the hands of police in the past 5 or so years, it's just not a drop in the bucket.
Mm-hmm.
So if you really want to do like real journalism and talk about what's really happening in the world of violence, then you. Yeah, I try to set the record straight and tell them, like, hey, this possible violence that might kind of sort of maybe happen,
mm-hmm.
it's a red herring when you set it against 300 or 400 police shootings in the past 5 years.
I think you're right, and I was also struck by that during Rahm Emanuel's, the mayor's press conference last week, just before the release of the video, and how it was all about, here's a quick clip from what he had to say. It was all about, oh, we got to keep it peaceful. We got to keep it peaceful.
I understand that the people will be upset and will want to protest when they see this video. But I would like to echo the comments of the McDonald family. They have asked for calm, and for those who choose to speak out, to do it peacefully. They said they do not want the violence to be resorted in Laquan's name, but let his legacy be better than that. It is fine to be passionate, but it is essential that it remain peaceful.
Now, that was Rahm Emanuel last week, just before the video of the shooting of Laquan McDonald was released. It's understandable that he would call for peace, but the emphasis seemed to be on that rather than his concerns about his own police force. Brandon Smith, today, Mayor Emanuel apparently fired Chicago Police Superintendent Gary McCarthy. That was just an hour or so ago before we go to air here right now. Any thoughts on that? Was that the appropriate thing to do by the mayor? And should he have done that last week rather than, you know, worrying about peaceful protests?
You know, I think if he had done it last week, it would have been a more clear message to police.
Mm-hmm.
Now that he's doing it today, like, it smacks a little bit more thoroughly of political strategy. But, you know, it also could be, he could take this opportunity to put someone in charge of police who is really gonna reform this horrible data, you know, like it's not just a culture that's mm-hmm. that's kind of nebulous. We know what's happening, and we can track this in real time. The Chicago Reader has reported that since 1986, 29 years ago, police have averaged one shooting a week of a Chicago citizen.
Mm.
Now, if it hasn't really slowed. I don't know. Gary McCarthy tried to say last week that police shootings have slowed, and he pulled like a number figure
mm-hmm.
Out of a hat, And we don't know where he got that figure, but the point is, it seems to have not slowed, and I and others want Rahm to address it, and I hope he will.
The Better Government Association had data that was put forward by William Calloway that you cited in your Guardian piece. People need to know that this is William Calloway being quoted here. People need to know that Chicago has some of the most police shootings in America, and that more than 70% of them are perpetrated against people of color. People need to know that communities of color are policed differently, policed much more violently than in predominantly white communities. And people need to know that police are not being held accountable, and all of this needs to change. There seems to be some accountability here for the moment in that Officer Van Dyke was finally charged. But as you've noted, I think also in a piece today that you wrote for The Beast, there was a bunch of other cops on that scene that knew about what happened over the past year. They were there, you know, live. They saw what happened. There was also an investigation that had access to this video over the past year. I got to tell you, I was speaking with someone recently at KPFK at the radio station about all of this, and I said I've never understood why police, aren't the ones to call these people out. They claim they're bad apples. Why they aren't the ones to call these people out right off the bat? Because it ultimately makes them look bad when their cops do something wrong. But the fact that there were so many people, so many other police who did nothing, who didn't report this, who didn't apparently make noise about it, who have not yet since been charged, suggests, well, it's not just bad apples, that there are. Does it suggest that same thing to you? Where is the accountability for all of these other police now that haven't been charged?
I think the accountability is going to come after we succeed in demanding transparency. My lawyer and I are, we still have this case open against the city, the one that pried the video loose, and mm-hmm. we're asking the city to turn over to us and put online all the documents related to Laquan's case. That would include emails back and forth inside the city and the police department, emails between them and the Independent Police Review Authority and, mm-hmm. And the Fraternal Order of Police. So it has the potential, if they comply, to show the public what really happened and who knew what at what time. And the public can judge whether justice was served and in a timely manner and whether anyone was trying to obstruct justice. You mentioned that some police may have given statements that showed what the video showed, mm-hmm. that described what the video showed. And in that case, why wasn't the officer charged immediately when there was someone testifying against him? But if they all gave statements saying that what Jason Van Dyke did was more or less okay, mm-hmm. then all of them must be complicit in some way.
Well, yeah, it would seem so. I mean, they knew about it. They were there. They did not. It doesn't seem that they, set off alarms and red flags that, hey, this guy, Jason Van Dyke, just went nuts. Shot this guy 16 times, I think 14 of the shots when he was already lying on the ground. It seems like they did nothing. And now it's the police union that has come along and paid for Jason Van Dyke's bail on Monday to get him out. So they seem to be sticking together here. And I want to talk, Brandon Smith, about your process in helping to unearth this video that we've all seen. But before we get to that point, apparently there are parts of surveillance tapes, I think, from a Burger King. This has been reported that the police actually went in and deleted. Is that confirmed? Are you able to confirm that? And do we know who these cops were and what their supposed reason was for going in and deleting evidence at a crime scene, essentially, by doing this?
We don't know any of that. That's the problem. People have been asking me a lot today, is mm-hmm. this a cover-up in your estimation? And I just have to say, by any reasonable definition of cover-up that I know, of course it is. The manager of the Burger King testified in front of the grand jury recently and mm-hmm. said that police detectives were in that room looking at the video or doing something with the video for a couple hours. And he said that when he was... to his knowledge, the video was all present, and then when they left, it was gone. So what is he to think?
Wow.
That's kind of what he testified. So, but police deny that they deleted the video. I don't know what they're thinking, that people will just think sometimes video shuts off for 86 minutes randomly.
So it's 86 minutes of video is now missing?
That's right.
Wow. And also, what happened to the sound on the dash cam video that has been released? Those usually have sound on them, do they not?
They do, and myself and some others are looking into that.
Okay, because all right, I guess you don't want to say more for now. It is strange that there seems to be some kind of sound that was distorted or removed from that videotape, which would also seem to me to be tampering with evidence. Brandon Smith, speaking with Brandon Smith, the independent journalist who sued to obtain the shooting video of Laquan McDonald by Officer Jason Van Dyke. Brandon, how did you come to hear about this story in the first place, and what led you to filing your lawsuit to get at the video?
Well, this friend of mine, William Calloway, he's an activist on the South Side. Mm-hmm. He is in touch with a lot of families that are victims of police violence. And so he heard about Laquan's story and brought it to my attention. And we went from there. He knew that I had previously filed a lot of freedom of information requests, and then had to sue government to get responses to them. So he thought that that's what needed to be done in this situation. And I guess he was right, because the judge ruled in my favor. So yeah, I mean, we're trying to essentially ask the police what are you going to do about this problem?
Uh-huh.
And we're doing it through demanding transparency.
What were you initially told when you made your FOIA request, your Freedom of Information Act request? Were you told anything, or were you just ignored?
I was ignored for the longest time, and I checked in several times over a couple months.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually they denied me like they denied 14 other reporters before me.
Mm-hmm.
And these other reporters, by and large, did not push back against that.
Any idea
why? The Wall Street Journal,
yeah, go ahead.
I don't know. It's, you know, I can't.
I mean, those were news organizations with a budget, right? I mean, these were corporate media outlets who might have been able to better afford to take legal action to get at this tape.
Absolutely. I mean, all of them probably have attorneys on retainer.
Uh-huh.
My attorney in this case is he works at no cost to me. He is basically asking the government for payment, since they were in the wrong in this case.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I'm sure, like in Illinois, there's a provision where attorneys can do that in freedom of information cases.
And you haven't talked to any of those corporate media outlets to say, hey, what happened? Why did you guys drop the ball? Why didn't, you know, why are you leaving this to me, a 29-year-old independent, you know, journalist and blogger, to bring this case? Brandon, this would have, it seems that this would have disappeared had it not been for you following up your own Freedom of Information Act request with an actual lawsuit. Do you feel it would have gone away?
No one was talking about it. I mean, I suspect some reporters may have asked their bosses to look into filing suit, but since no one else did, I can only assume that executives at these outlets decided, no, we're not going to do that. You know, I can't say specifically why anyone chose not to mm-hmm. sue anyone else, but I can kind of speak to this practice where journalists get really close to their sources, particularly government sources. And if you're relying on your government source to give you stories all the time, you're not going to want to do something like sue them when they tell you no.
And that, I think that likely does come into play here. I've seen that happen. And these are folks, these are corporate media outlets who have to cover the police all the time. Is it true that some in the local media were asking you after this happened if you were concerned about being the victim of violent retribution from the police?
No, I was never concerned because I know that this is kind of business as usual for them. They face judgments and settlements all the time, and that's part of the problem. They're not using their own money, really. They're kind of using tax dollars and getting to play with it.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, this was more impactful, of course, like on a personal level to a lot of people. But I was never afraid because I was kind of a character in the story from day one. When people started covering it, they would say like, "Oh," they would just say that I was behind it, and I just figured if something happened to me, that a lot of people would be really angry.
Well, that's an optimistic way to look at it. I've got just a minute or so left here, Brandon. When this press conference happened last week with Mayor Emanuel announcing that the video would be released and calling for peaceful protests, all of which I think, to my understanding, there has been protests in Chicago since then, but they have all remained largely peaceful. Is that correct?
Absolutely.
Okay. So there was this press conference. You apparently, as journalists who helped bring out this video, were barred from the press conference. You described it, I think I saw you on, I think it was Rachel Maddow, you had said that it was, quote, due to some technicality that you were not allowed into the presser with the mayor. What the hell was that technicality, Brandon?
I was told at the door that because I didn't have a press credential, official credential issued by the police department, that I wasn't allowed inside. The room was too full to allow anyone without a credential. So maybe the department in the city just they didn't think of me specifically and allow for me prior to the event. And uh-huh. I guess I understand that. They were busy. But hey, if they had worked actively to prohibit me, this would be an easy way to do it. Who knows what happened? It doesn't matter. I'm just trying to report the story of police brutality in Chicago.
And you're doing a good job. You, even though you weren't in that press conference, you were able to get this question to a reporter who was in the press conference. I want to play this question and Rahm Emanuel's answer real quick and get your response to his answer.
Mr. Mayor, a question from Brandon Smith, the independent journalist who fought the city for the release of this video. He said he wasn't allowed into this press conference today. He wants to know, quote, will you move to reform the wider culture of policing that has led to 300 shootings in 5 years?
Anybody who is there to uphold the law cannot act like they're above the law. And that is both a principle that is used to make sure it reflects the culture in the police department. And I want to say one thing. There are men and women, both in leadership essential and rank and file, who follow and live by that principle every day. Jason Van Dyke does not represent the police department, because I can give you chapter and verse of people who are doing things that are beyond what their quote-unquote only their job description is, who every day go out not just to protect but also to serve. Do we have to make changes? Absolutely. It's always working towards a culture that understands that you're accountable. It's an honor to serve the public, and because you serve the public, you're not above the law, but you actually are there, and you'll be held accountable like everybody else, and accountable not just like everybody else, but to a higher standard.
So that was Mayor Emanuel last week saying that Officer Van Dyke does not represent the Chicago police, a response to a question sent into the room by Brandon Smith. Brandon, your response that Officer Van Dyke does not represent the Chicago police?
Well, he may not represent 80% of Chicago police or 85% of the police or something, maybe 90. But there's a huge chunk of officers. And remember, there are like 12,500 officers in this city.
Hmm.
If 10% of the officers would have overused their force in a situation similar to Laquan's,
mm-hmm.
that means that 10% of officers need to be retrained, you know? And 10% of 12,500 is a lot of officers. It's
yeah.
not one bad apple or five bad apples. It's many hundred, you know? So, or or 1,000 mm-hmm. or something, you know. Mm-hmm. So it's a big issue, and it needs a lot of reform. And I know it's not going to be easy, but I feel like it's worth the money. You know, like our city budget is something like 1/3 goes to the police department, and so it's a fiscal issue. Frankly, it's mm-hmm. it's not even like if you remove the like moral issue of how communities of color are policed more violently. Like, we could just talk about it as a fiscal issue. It doesn't make sense to keep going at this rate and not discipline and retrain and have accountability so that people trust police, and we need fewer police ultimately.
And it seems amazing to me that they would, you know, pay $5 million to the family. We see this all over the country where the police just simply are constantly paying out millions and millions of dollars in settlements. That's taxpayer money, and people are not held accountable. Brandon, my friend Jason Leopold, I don't know if you know, do you know Jason by any chance?
I do. I mean, he and I have corresponded a few times. I'm a big fan of his.
Okay, good. So are we. He's, of course, now at Vice. He has filed literally hundreds of these things to the point where he's described as a FOIA terrorist by some in the federal government before. I know you wrote today that you plan on continuing to do this. You put out a list of things that you are insisting that the city produce here. What are the sort of the top one or two items that you would like to see now from the city, and do you feel you will get it, or will you have to go back to suing for each and every one of these things?
That's a good question. I don't know what the city's going to do with our request. They can either comply or they can take it back to the judge in my case and object to it. Mm-hmm. And the judge can either sustain their objection or order them to give it up. But it, in this case, is things like emails internal to the city, mm-hmm. that is the police department or the mayor's office, the city legal department, those kinds of places. All kinds of emails, communications regarding this case. You know, we want to know who knew what about the case and how long they kept it hidden and kept that story out there that Laquan was acting erratically and threatening officers and all this. And not only that, but keeping the video secret and fighting the release of the video, which would tell people that this was a murder, according to the prosecutors. So emails and internal communications are one. I'd really like to have also the audio of the tapes, if it exists, or at least an accounting as to who's responsible for the disappearance of it. Mm-hmm. And probably statements from all the officers there to see if any of them are minimizing what happened or giving drastically different stories from one another.
Yeah, I think the video is really the tip of the iceberg here. There's been a year of conversation about this during the cover-up. So it seems like there's a lot more to come on this. And I hope, Brandon, that you will stay with it. It sounds like you will. Would you recommend, by the way, other people in other cities take similar action here? Is this easy for citizens, private citizens, independent journalists to do?
It really is. Yeah, I mean, like, hell, the U.S. Constitution spells out that journalists don't have special privilege. That is, its corollary is that anyone can be a journalist. So the Freedom of Information Act, whether it's the federal one or any of the state ones, mm-hmm. most states have them, you know, that can be used by anyone. So if you're reading a news story and something seems fishy to you, you can ask for any document or piece of information. It's your government. It's like your responsibility, and mine too, to hold them accountable for what they do with their positions of power.
Well said. Brandon Smith, holding them accountable. Check out his work. Well, he's writing all over the place these days, but his blog site is Muckrakery. Showing powerful people the consequences of their actions since 2007. You can find that at brandonsmith.com, and you can follow him on the Twitters at Muckrakery. Brandon, thanks for all your good work here, and thanks for joining us today on the broadcast.
Hey, thanks for having me on and covering the story. It's really important what you guys do.
Thank you, sir. Keep up the good work. All right, we're going to take a quick break, and we are back with more Bradcast right after this. I'm Brad Friedman. Stay tuned.
Chicago, Chicago, that toddling town.
Yeah.
Chicago.
Welcome back to the Bradcast. Chicago, Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. Of course, it's not just Chicago. It's the whole country. We got a problem in this country. Black teens are 21 times as likely as white teens to be shot and killed by police between 2010 and 2012, according to a ProPublica analysis of the available FBI data, which frankly may underreport the concerns. ProPublica's Ryan Gabrielson, Ryan Grachowski-Jones, and Eric Segarra reported, quote, "One way of appreciating the stark disparity, according to the analysis, is to calculate how many more whites over those 3 years, those same 3 years from 2010 to 2012, would have had to have been killed for the black population and the white population to be at equal risk. The number is jarring, they say. 185 more would have to have been killed. That's more than one per week during those 3 years. The disparities appear to be even starker for unarmed suspects. According to an analysis of 2015 police killings by The Guardian, racial minorities made up about 37.4% of the general population, but 46.6% of armed and unarmed victims. But they make up 62.7% of unarmed people that are killed by police. Racial minorities, 62.7%. When they're unarmed and they're killed by police, you can almost bet your bottom dollar that they will be some form of minority. Meanwhile, that comment that you heard from Mayor Rahm Emanuel about Jason Van Dyke not representing the police department, I hope not. Because at least 18 civil complaints were filed against Van Dyke over the past several years, according to the New York Times, which obtained copies of those complaints. In one instance, Van Dyke was accused of slamming people down while executing a search warrant, calling everyone the N-word, and falsely arresting multiple individuals. A second instance of alleged misconduct involved Van Dyke choking a man during a drunk driving investigation because he had a cough drop in his mouth. Van Dyke also was accused of bending the man's arm backwards, quote, excessively. 7 years ago, Van Dyke was involved in the arrest of Eddie Nance. He slammed Nance into the hood of his squad car, which tore his rotator cuffs. A jury awarded $350,000 in damages 2 years later. But in all of the above examples, the Independent Police Review Authority, IPRA, in Chicago, determined that Van Dyke's conduct was justified in every case. I don't know what else you could do for a living that you would have to, where your employer would have to constantly pay out people who made complaints against you, $350,000 in damages, $5 million to the McDonald family for killing Laquan McDonald. I don't know what else you could do, have that kind of a record and still keep your job. But as I say, of course, it's not only Chicago, not by a long shot. And the way these cops pull together, and I'm really, I'm in favor of cops. I'm not against cops, but it seems to me these cops need to be the one to step forward, need to call out these people in their midst for their misbehavior, and frankly, they consistently do exactly the opposite. Their behavior is just atrocious, not just those that, we catch on videotape, but the way, Brandon Smith was talking about, there was five or six or seven other cops who were there at that shooting who did not come forward, who did not say that what Officer Van Dyke did was outrageous. They sat there and, I guess, said nothing for a year. But it's not, as I say, not just Chicago. One day after Robert Louis Deer allegedly opened fire at the Planned Parenthood clinic in Colorado last week, killing three and injuring nine others, the Colorado Fraternal Order of Police, again, that's the police union, they're the ones who bailed out the Chicago Fraternal Order of Police, the ones who gave the bail money to Officer Van Dyke to release him on Monday. The Colorado Fraternal Order of Police, after that shooting at the Planned Parenthood, issued a statement calling critics race-baiting morons and delusional, ignorant fools. These are police. These are police putting out statements like that. That statement was posted on the police union's Facebook page, came in response to the outrage over officers' treatment of white killers like Robert Louis Deer, who was handcuffed and taken into custody alive after killing a cop. Critics say, of course, the minority wouldn't have had that the same sort of gentle treatment. The Fraternal Order of Police in Colorado said in their statement, "What the race-baiting morons who believe that he was spared because he was white failed to acknowledge is that this year alone, there have been numerous shootings of police officers where the suspects were taken into custody. Many of those suspects were persons of color." No, I don't think that's what the race-baiting morons are failing to see. In addition to slamming their critics, the Colorado Fraternal Order of Police perpetuated the misconception that saying Black Lives Matter means other lives do not. In their statement, they said, "Sadly, there are race-baiting, delusional, ignorant fools with an agenda of hate that use any tragic event to peddle their corrupted opinion," the group wrote. Again, these are police officers putting this out as an official statement. "What they don't understand is our job is to preserve life, not take it. You see, for us, all lives matter." Well done, Colorado Fraternal Order of Police. Way to instill confidence in the people you are supposed to serve and protect. Just amazing. In any event, my thanks to our producer, Desi Doyen. I hope you are feeling better. I hope I soon will be feeling better. My thanks, of course, to our booking goddess, Cynthia Cohn. Thank you, Cynthia. Hope you had a pleasant holiday and that you're not sick. And to my guest today, Brandon Smith of BrandonSmith.com. Imagine the nerve of an independent journalist naming a website after himself. Also, my thanks to our friend Nicole Sandler of RadioOrNot.com for covering for us last week. We will be with you same Brad time, same Brad channel tomorrow. Until then, as ever, you can find us over at bradblog.com if you missed any portion of our show, or you can download it from iTunes. Take your pick. You can drop me email. I am bradcast@bradblog.com, and you can follow me on the Twitters and the Facebooks at The Brad Blog. That's it. We'll see you soon. Until next time, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.